Parnassus Foundation. DubLab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis LA and DubLab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello?
Hello, can I please speak with Sarah Broom? Sarah, it's such a pleasure to speak with you. This is Paul Holdengraber calling you. Thank you for taking my call.
This is wonderful. I've been looking forward to this call.
Well, me too. Me too, for so many reasons. And I think the one of the main reasons is just the excitement I feel reading and rereading The Yellow House. It's truly a magnificent voyage, and I'm also so pleased that though our phone call got a little delayed, it got delayed to so many rave reviews you've had. How does that all feel?
It's really a full feeling I have. I dislike the word overwhelming because I think to feel overwhelmed is a pleasurable thing. But this is it's coming from all quarters and from writers I really admire and critics whose brains I love. So I'm just trying to take it all in, you know?
Do you recognize yourself, or do you recognize the Yellow House in these reviews?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I don't actually read reviews. Okay, so that's the thing. My friends call me, and then they give me reviews of the reviews, which are a lot of fun, by the way. I think it's more fun than reading the review itself. And I don't read reviews because, first of all, my partner is a filmmaker, also doesn't read reviews, and so I'm trained to help her think about what people are saying about the work. And also, it allows me a kind of purity, in a sense, you know, my relationship to the work, because I feel that if I believe the rave review, then I'll also be required to believe the bad review, you know?
I love that.
So
I love that.
I choose not to read them at all.
Well, let me tell you that Dwight Garner uses two words to describe your style, and I must say, it really resonated with me because the book, the biography of this house, is so affected by these two qualities. He says that your style is alert and inquisitive, and the search for the Yellow House, now disappeared, the anchor of your childhood, is exactly that, alert and inquisitive. And I'd like to start by pointing out that among the things I love the most in your book, which perhaps may not surprise you since I'm a quotomaniac by profession, are your epigrams, which are just magnificent. And I'd like to start with the very first one, in a way, because I think it will permit you to say so many things, perhaps. Or perhaps the two first ones, which are on the very first page of The Yellow House. You have one by Kai Miller.
Yes.
Draw me a map of what you see, then I will draw a map of what you never see, and guess me whose map will be bigger than whose. And then Peter Turchi, who I don't know, says, to learn how to read any map is to be indoctrinated into that mapmaker's culture. So those two epigrams are epigraphs are just extraordinary, and perhaps you can let us know why they are the opening door to the Yellow House.
Oh, I love that you noticed that, Paul. That's one of the things that's amazing about you, because I don't know how many people are talking about the epigraph, but I spent a really long time thinking about what they would be. The Kai Miller I discovered, actually, when I was in Rome. I was on holiday in Rome, maybe a year ago. So I was finishing a pretty big revision of the book, and I brought Kai Miller along just to read a book of his poetry, and I came upon this. And the book has an incredible title. It's something like "The Mapmaker Charts His Way to Zion." It's something that might not be exactly it, but it's this incredible title. And I read this, and it felt to me like the heart of what I was trying to do, right? Which is, in a way, become a kind of cartographer. I say a kind of cartographer because I don't really trust cartographers, right? Nor do I trust maps, because I think historically in America and elsewhere, they are documents that essentially frame out certain people, right, and certain narratives. So, but I do think that in the world itself, I was trying to revise a map that most people understand about New Orleans, right, and kind of add these new points on the map and talk about all these people I loved who were essentially cut off from the map. And then the Peter Turchi quotation, I love this quotation so much, because in a way, what I wish the reader will do, right, to learn how to read any map. And I feel like my experience as a woman in America, as a Black woman in America, a Southern Black woman, is that I have learned to read many different maps, right? Maps that don't belong to me, maps of foreign places. I have, in some cases, become fluid, you know, in the language of these maps. And I am asking for that same thing, that I'm laying out for you in the beginning of this book a map, and if you can figure out how to read it, you will have a different kind of entrance.
How to read it, how to get lost, how to find your way around a space in New Orleans, namely the Yellow House, that sometimes is absent from all maps.
Sure. And that, you know, doesn't fit neatly into a kind of story about New Orleans, right? And I think to have what comes up for me also, Paul, is the idea of patience, that who is allowed a kind of time when they're telling a story, right? Who gets the benefit of the doubt, right? And I really want the reader to unlock me and take their time. I'm trying to lay a certain kind of foundation. And that mattered so much to me. So the Peter Turchi quotation really speaks to that.
I remember meeting Kai Miller in Calabash in Jamaica, and was very, very, very struck by his poetry. And then reading those two quotations, as I said at the beginning, and which you amplified so beautifully, it is really the opening to that the door of the Yellow House. And, you know, to move very quickly forward, because you talked about Kai Miller being one of your companions, as it were, in Rome, there's a passage I love about who will be the companions to you, to your days in Burundi. And you have this paragraph, which I will read, and then I'll have you comment on. During the three-hour siestas on weekends, I mostly sat inside reading books and writing letters. I treated my books like people complaining about which ones I brought with me. Mavis Gallant was a mistake, I wrote in a letter. So was Henry James. Mark Twain was a brilliant idea. I read more hours than I worked at the radio station. Gail Jones's Corregidora for the fifth time, Elizabeth Hardwick's Sleepless Nights, and James Baldwin's Evidence of Things Not Seen. My letters were full of quotations from these books, and I said what I could not. My memory stammers, but my soul is a witness, Baldwin wrote. And from Rilke's Notebooks of Malte Lorenz-Brügge, I don't want to write any more letters. What's the use of telling someone that I'm changing? If I'm changing, I am no longer who I was. And if I'm someone else, it's obvious that I have no acquaintances and I can't possibly write to strangers. Well, he's right, I wrote to a friend. But me, I can't stop talking to paper. Kisses, darling. Bring us back to the, bring us back to that moment.
Oh, I just closed my eyes listening to you read, which I think can only happen over the phone. That brought back so much for me, Paul, because it's hard to overstate what, in a way, because that 1 year in Burundi was an enormously lonely year, and I think people throw around the word lonely, but I remember finding out, in actuality, what loneliness felt like. I thought I had been lonely before, but when I was there for a year, I realized I'd never been lonely, and I was very lonely that year, and I was, in a strange way, also becoming a writer, because I was writing. I have now 500 pages or so, front and back, of letters I was writing to people that contain all of the stories of my days and what it meant to read and to have writers as a kind of accompaniment. That 1 year taught me so much about the ways in which our literature, our art, is always in a literal and actual conversation with other artists' work, right? It helped me understand that these two things aren't disparate at all, that we're sort of part of this great big organism as artists. And I think that part of the way that I like to write is to have all of these influences live inside the work. And just remembering all of the reading and the thinking I did in Burundi reminds me how sort of crucial that moment was in kind of shaping me, you know, as this kind of thinker and writer who had all of these other sort of influences and forces who I was sort of talking to in my own work.
There is a line you quote from Toni Morrison, which strikes me twice as strongly rereading it now than when I read it for the first time a few months ago, which is, "Water has a perfect memory," Toni Morrison has said, "and is forever trying to get back to where it was." That line, in the context of the story of the yellow house, is very powerful. Perhaps you can say something both about that line and about your relationship not only with water, but also with Toni Morrison.
What I wonder is, actually, could I read the full paragraph?
Of course you can. Please do.
But the thing that is in my heart and that I read almost every day while writing was the whole paragraph, so I'll read it. So she actually said, just to give a little bit of context, she said, so in an essay called The Site of Memory, you know, they straightened out the Mississippi River in places to make room for houses and livable acreage. Occasionally, the river floods these places, Flood is the word they use, but in fact, it is not flooding. It is remembering, remembering where it used to be. All water has a perfect memory and is forever trying to get back to where it was. Writers are like that, remembering where we were, what valley we ran through, what the banks were like, the light that was there, and the route back to our original place. It is emotional memory, what the nerves and the skin remember, as well as how it appeared. And a rush of imagination is our flooding.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
The work, Toni Morrison's body of work. Let me back up a little bit. So I'm the youngest of 12 children. I think you know that.
I do. I do. And not only do I know it.
Now everyone knows that.
Yeah, now I was about to say, now everybody knows it. And everybody knows the spaces in between you as housed in the yellow house.
Yes, exactly. And so being the youngest, there were moments in the reporting of this book and often in the writing where I had to gain a kind of courage just to be able to write the story that felt impossible, because I felt in a lot of ways that it wasn't, in certain ways I felt it wasn't my story to tell, right? Because I was talking about a kind of history that came before me. But often I would read that paragraph about memory, about history, about a kind of naturalness to things, right? That's what I get from it. And it would drive me to doing my work. And, you know, the thing about Morrison, which matters so much to me, is that she was in love with what it, herself, I think, and what it meant to be Black and what it meant to come from a Black family. And she always wrote about nuance and the complication of that. And it was always grounded in context and in history. And then beyond that, right? So just on the level of what's happening with the sentences, I think people underestimate what it means for someone to write something that makes you feel, right? I mean, when I tell somebody, if I go to a film and I sit and I move by something, that's my highest feeling about a piece of art, right? And so to open any page of Toni Morrison, which I could do right now and read it, you know, and feel moved by it, and to think about how someone built a sentence that contains so much, is massive for me. So Toni Morrison's works for me are biblical texts, you know, like the Bible. And I read them not just for the story she's telling, but as a kind of student of craft and just trying to figure out how you make a sentence like that.
You have said that without Toni Morrison, perhaps your late vocation of writing wouldn't have come into play.
Sure, I believe that. I am someone who is really interested in context. And so for me, Toni Morrison is critical to and crucial and a kind of beginning for me. But then there are other writers too who are surrounding me in a way, right? Or who I think of as surrounding me.
Who are they? Who are they? Sarah, you knew I would ask you. You can't say
you can't say
Sarah to me a sentence like that without my wanting to say, Sarah, tell me, who are those writers? I think I know a few, but I want you to say them without me prompting you.
Sure. So there are certain poets who are responsible for me in a way, right? So Jack Gilbert, June Jordan, who I went to UC Berkeley for. She died the semester before I started, but I went to Berkeley for her. Zabald, W.G. Zabald, John Edgar Wideman, Jamaica Kincaid's book, Autobiography of My Mother, is kind of central to who I am as a thinker and as a writer, of Joan Didion, Katia, I love so much. And Baldwin, of course, Baldwin, right? Elizabeth Hardwick, who we mentioned earlier. So these are sort of the firmaments, in a way, of writers who I feel surround me. And some of them particularly are obsessed with place, the way that I'm obsessed with place. And so that's like Edward P. Jones and the way he talks about D.C., right? And that's, of course, Didion talking about California. And I've always thought of myself as somebody who cared enormously about places. So those are my people.
How can I choose to single out one, or if I'm singling out just one, but maybe two, maybe just one, perhaps one that in the pantheon of writers that surround you and nurture you and feed you and nourish you, there is one in particular I would like to single out, because it's a passion we share. And we share it in part because you shared that passion with me early on. And that is, that is Jack Gilbert. Do you have a poem of his you might read?
Sure. I thought about that too, see. I somehow intuited that you would ask this question. And for me, so the poem that I return to over and over from Jack Gilbert is one called The Forgotten Dialect of the Heart.
Yeah.
And it says, how astonishing it is that language can almost mean, and frightening that it does not quite. Love, we say, God, we say, Rome and Mexico, we write, and the words get it all wrong. We say bread, and it means according to which nation. French has no word for home, and we have no word for strict pleasure. A people in northern India is dying out because their ancient tongue has no words for endearment. I dream of lost vocabulary that might express some of what we no longer can. Maybe the Etruscan text would finally explain why the couples on their tombs are smiling, and maybe not. When the thousands of mysterious Sumerian tablets were translated, they seemed to be business records. But what if they are poems or songs? My joy is the same as 12 Ethiopian goats standing silent in the morning light. O Lord, thou art slabs of salt and ingots of copper, as grand as ripe barley light under the wind's labor. Her breasts are 6 white oxen loaded with bolts of long-fibered Egyptian cotton. My love is 100 pitchers of honey. Shiploads of suya are what my body wants to say to your body. To wrap or this desire in the dark. Perhaps the spiral Minoan script is not language but a map. What we feel most has no name but ambers, archers, cinnamon, horses, and birds. Isn't that something?
As you can hear, it really is. I mean, there's so many. You introduced me years ago to Jack Gilbert, and reading him, you know, passionately. Since then, this poem is tremendous. My own favorite, I think, is a poem called "Failing and Flying," which is so powerful. I'm not going to read it, but I'm going to invite everybody who's overhearing us to read Jack Gilbert, to read his collected poems, to read his little book, The Refusal of Heaven, I think it's called, which is just an extraordinary little collection, and to read his fantastic Paris Review interview, which is really one of the grand great ones. And, you know, I single out in the poem the word house because of French not having that word, because there's another epigraph which I think is central to your book, by another great, great poet who was not only a poet, but a postman, and not only a postman, but a great philosopher. And that is Gaston Bachelard. And you have a wonderful epigraph, and I will amplify it and then have you speak about the yellow house in the context of Bachelard. You say, the things we have forgotten are housed. Our soul is an abode, and by remembering houses and rooms, we learn to abide within ourselves. That is your epigraph. And then I was reminded of another one. And I found the English translation of it. It's in La Poétique de l'Espace, Poetics of Space. He says, a psychoanalyst, thanks to the house, a great many memories are housed. A psychoanalyst should turn his attention to the simple localization of memories. I should like to give the name of topoanalysis to this auxiliary of psychoanalysis. To psychoanalysis, then, would be the systematical psychological study of the sites of our intimate lives. And maybe a third one where Bachelard says, the house shelters daydreaming. The house protects the dreamer. The house allows one to dream in peace. Well, the last one is perhaps the most difficult one to make rhyme with your book, because so many of the dreams were shattered with the yellow house disappearing.
It's just rushing over me. And what I love so much about Poetics of Space and Bachelard's work is the philosophy of it. And it, I read his work as a kind of beginning. I read his work before I started writing anything about the house, because I wasn't interested in only writing about a physical house. Right? I was trying to write about a kind of psychological house.
Right.
About the literal house, but a psychological
right,
house.
Right, right, right.
I thought of the composition of a book as a house. I thought of the act of writing the book as a kind of resurrection of the house with words.
And exactly that, the way the book was written, you might mention to those who are listening to us, it's a symphonic book made in four movements and an afterthought, as it were.
Sure, yeah. This I thought a lot about how the book would be set up. And I thought a lot about what about the structure is also communicating something, right? So New Orleans is, you know, the definite thing about New Orleans, this is less myth and just the real thing. But it's this incredibly musical place, right? And so I wanted the structure of the book to contain, in its bearing, so to speak, right, a kind of ode and nod to that. And I wanted also, thinking architecturally, going back to Bachelard, right, and the idea of how you compose a structure and a place, right? How you sort of contain yourself within something. I needed the movement to contain pieces of a very big story and to be allowed to have their own tone and pacing, right, and rhythm at times. And I wanted, in a kind of theoretical sense, for one to be able to read them singularly, but to get, you know, the greatest effect from taking them all in, right? And I think that's symphonic, like you said, but it also reminds me a lot of someone like Sun Ra. It reminds me of Ornette Coleman's music. It reminds me of John Coltrane. It reminds me of even a lot of African music and the way that it's sort of composed, right? So for me, the idea of making a kind of house, making a house out of a book, and thinking about, okay, when the person enters the front door, what do they understand, right? But what do they know when they're a room in or two rooms in? What do they know by the time they're at the back door? And I think you're right in a sense about the dreaming and peace being difficult, but not always, I'd say, because one of the things that I'm contending with in the work is, do houses always do their job, right? Because growing up, I understood a house is to keep us in, right? To sort of give the illusion of protection and safety from the outside.
The illusion.
So this, what, yeah, I think so. Because technically, anyone can bust down your door. I mean, really. The moment you hire a locksmith, you realize that. You say, this is not that hard to do.
Right.
Right? And so these are all kind of, I think of them as illusions, but they're important illusions. And for me, at moments in the Yellow House, I felt that I was outside, inside, right? That I had no barrier, really, between the outside world and the inside world. Except that the inside world was the world my mother had made. And the fact that my mother had made this world, that she had sewn the curtains for every single door, that she had labored and mopped and swept and bleached every damn thing in sight, made it a very capable world where I actually could call dream and peace. And I think that is the complication for me. That was the rub. That was the tension.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.